From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. What gives this mess some grace? I easily fall for bands that are literate and love the electric guitar. I can also be a sucker for bands that make conceptual records, and so it's easy to see why I love the music of this band, Acaville River. On a dark, windless night, with the stereo on, with the towns flying by, and the ground getting soft, and a sound in the sky, coming down from above, it surrounds you and sighs, and it's whispering of. This is from Acaville River's 2007 CD called The Stage Names. For NPR listeners, it was one of the 20 best records of the year. Now, there's a new CD by this Austin band. It's sort of a sister album to The Stage Names. It's called The Stand-Ins. From time to time, we invite guest DJs on All Songs Considered. And since the music of Acaville River is so full of music trivia and club life, I thought the band's guiding light, singer and songwriter Will Sheff, would make a great DJ. He joins us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Well, Chef, when you grew up, did you have somebody in your life who was sort of your musical handholder, the person who sort of took you down the road and helped you discover music?
There's no one person who sticks out in my mind as a musical mentor. Our only recourse was like friends' parents' records or some old sort of hippie painter guy, artsy guy two towns over who apparently had some kind of cool record collection. And you'd go and befriend this guy. And he'd give you stuff that to you seemed like it was from entirely another planet. You know, the Incredible String Band was that way for me. When I started listening to the Incredible String Band, I couldn't believe it was real. It seemed like it had nothing to do with the very mainstream 80s pop I was hearing on the radio and with the classic rock my parents listened to.
Hey, Will, and they were from another planet, actually.
I think that they actually were. It warped my mind hearing that stuff really early. And even somebody who, at the time, I didn't realize that Tom Waits was very well known, but when we first heard Tom Waits, we heard the album Frank's Wild Years, me and my high school friends, and it seemed also very bonkers to us. We really had no frame of reference for it. That more weird Brechtian stuff that he was doing in the 80s, that to us seemed totally insane, and we had no one to ask about it. And if you ask your average adult living in a small town who Tom Waits is, they're not going to know. So it was really funny to me when I went away to college and found out that he was a well-known guy, because to us that seemed like another kind of total oddball who dropped in from out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But then when I heard something like the Incredible String Band, I thought, I really didn't know that music could be like this. I didn't know it could be so unbelievably strange. And the way that they would play with tuning and things would be out of tune and very, very horribly out of tune, almost to the point where it became like a flavor, or that they would, tempos would change very drastically. Instruments I'd never heard of would be very prominent, very loud in the mix. It was very, very bold, and my parents hated it, and everyone hated it. And so in this weird way, as acoustic and hippy-dippy as that stuff was, it was kind of like my punk rock. They had so much faith, almost a ridiculous, silly amount of faith in what music could be and what music could do. This idea that music could be like casting a spell and it could reorder the entire world around the song that you're playing. And if you're a teenager, that idea seems completely non-ridiculous and completely serious. And it really had a massive impression on me.
Can we play some, because there are going to be an awful lot of people who don't know the Incredible String Band. I have some in my library. I had the pleasure of seeing them when they were in their heyday. And they were mystical and magical. And if you took it out of context, it really does seem like silly stuff. And maybe playing it now will feel silly to some people. But let's give people an idea what the Incredible String Band sound like. Thank you.
bent twig of darkness grows the petals of the morning and shows to them the birds singing just behind the dawning. Come dip into the cloud cream laughing. I can't keep my hand on the plow because it's dying, but I will lay me down with my arms round the rainbow, and I will lay me down to Christmas tree be shining gently all around.
So that's a Mike Heron song, Mike Heron singing. Robin Williamson is also in the band. Was the record album title was what, 5,000 Layers?
5,000 Spirits or the Layers of the Onion.
Right. Great music from 1967. Joe Boyd produced that record. Joe Boyd's been a DJ on our show. I'm here with Will Sheff, and Will is in Tempe, Arizona at KJZZ, NPR member station. And playing DJ for us, Will, of course, from Aukerville River. Pick us something else. Pick us some piece of music that I've never heard.
This is a song that I was recently in a record store and had a gift certificate, and I was with my friend Jason Hot Tub Callahan, and I said to him, give me something that I've never heard. And he said, oh, have you heard this Zelda record? And I hadn't. It's a record, I believe, from 1972 by a singer who's hugely successful and well-known in Turkey. And this is from a period where she went from being a very conventional folk singer to simultaneously getting very, very political, in fact, so political that she was jailed, and injecting a whole lot of different influences into her music. So basically, the band became incredibly funky, and there was this really strange psychedelic aspect to everything. And the saz, which is like a Turkish stringed instrument, started sounding like an electric guitar. And there's something about the sort of intervals that they're using, the Turkish sort of intervals, that starts to sound extremely heavy metal. And so there's this weird thing on this song of incredibly impassioned folk-based protest music with a incredibly funky beat, a very, very legitimately metal guitar sound, and just these odd, very eccentric psychedelic touches. There's really nothing that I have ever heard that sounds like this.
Well, I've never heard.
It's an incredible record.
I've never heard Zelda, so let's give a listen to it. Do you know the name of the song we're going to play?
It's called Inje. I don't know exactly even how that's pronounced, but this is my favorite song on a record that is full of incredible songs.
Thank you.
Boy. Now, that sounds... I'd put that around the early 70s. Do you know?
I think it's 72. It may be 74. Yeah.
It's so pushed to the edge, and I don't think it's just the fact that we got a MP3 file of this. I think it's just the way it was recorded. Everything was just pushed to the wall.
Yeah, and I believe that they don't know where the masters are for that, and so what you're actually hearing is the best version that they could find of a already pressed LP. So it kind of has that, and the result is this kind of weird, like you're hearing it through a bad radio kind of effect, which as much as that is not the purest idea of what, you know, the engineers and producers originally intended, I think that also kind of adds to the it coming out of another world.
And it sounds thing. Very urgent that way.
The sense of intensity and urgency in her voice is incredible, and the way that every now and then the meter just entirely breaks down so that she can just sort of scream about political issues of Turkey circa 1974 is pretty intense. You can tell she's pounding on that acoustic guitar. Her voice is beautiful, but very, very frighteningly urgent, frighteningly passionate.
And that's Zelda. We'll put these songs up online for you to hear. And we're talking to Will Sheff from Acaville River. Well, you got me. I certainly hadn't heard Zelda before. So thank you. And let's hear some more. What do you got?
This next song is a Dion from Dion and the Belmonts, the famous singer from the doo-wop era. He sort of descended into drug addiction and alcoholism. And I guess at a certain point he kind of hit rock bottom and sort of became born again. And he recorded this record with, I guess there's a whole lot of celebrity guests on it, and it was Phil Spector was producing it. And it's the whole album is called Born to Be With You. Anyway, there's a quality to Dion's voice. He sounds so so confident and so realistic and so grounded and very, very emotional and very masculine. And this one song is called Your Own Backyard. And it's a song about his experiences being a junkie and about hitting rock bottom and about deciding to turn his life around. And it is the best song I've ever heard about that. And there's a quality of complete absence of moralizing, a complete personal talking to the listener in a very unpretentious, plain way. And the melody and the recording are all beautiful. I love this song.
I've been sitting here thinking about when I started in drinking. I went on a dope, surely to change my life. Woo. I cried a tear and a beer for me. I lost everything near and dear to me, namely my children and my wife. I'm my idea of having a good time, sitting with my head between my knees. I knew everything there was to know, everything except which way to go. I cried, oh God, take me with you, please. Yeah, many a time I swore up and down I didn't need any of this junk that was going round. Let me finish what I got. After all, this stuff sure costs a lot. Then I'll get my feet back on the ground. Oh, I can't tell nobody how to live their life, even though inside we're all the same. All those things are toys I was playing with. Yeah.
Dan DiMucci, he's turning somewhere like near 60 years old, and I don't know if you know this, he's got a new record coming out.
Which, I didn't know that.
Which I just got in, and it comes out at the end of September. It comes out September 30th. You have a new record out. It's called The Stand-Ins, and you know, you might get tired of doing this, but you have to explain to people the relationship between the two records you've done.
Every time I'm making a record, I just sort of start writing, and as I'm writing, I start to feel like I understand the sort of color and feel of the record and what the songs are. And as I'm working, I start to very, very gently push them in a certain direction. And I'm really not thinking about, oh, you know, 10 songs and I'm done and I can get the record done. There we go. I'm just sort of trying to like work through some kind of a thought process about the sounds and the melodic stuff and the imagery and the language and how it's all going to work. In the case of both Black Sheep Boy and even more so on the Stage Names material, I came into the rehearsal process and immediately we knew, well, we have enough for definitely more than one record, probably more than two records. And so it became a matter of going, well, what do we do with this stuff? Do we just forever vault it, or do we try to make a double record? And we felt really, really positive about so many of the songs. And even there was briefly sort of a giddy, let's make a double record movement going, but I think cooler heads prevailed in the band, and we sort of started to realize that as much as I love Exile on Main Street, as much as I love London Calling, I don't really listen to them all in one sitting. I think a double records are often something you sort of cherry pick your favorite songs from. So we thought it would be nice to sort of take the songs and separate them into two different sets and release them kind of a year apart. And so some songs we decided early on, that's going to be later. And then other songs we decided as we were working. So I think that, you know, the difference between the two, there is a sort of a slight sonic difference. There's a little bit more of a ragged edge to the Stage Names. There's a little bit more of a swells and sort of ebbing and flowing to the music on the Stand-Ins. There's a little bit of a quality where the Stand-Ins is a rebuttal to some of the themes and ideas on the Stage Names. You know, there's like an idea that you might totally believe in on the Stage Names that the Stand-Ins tries to undercut and deflate and
destroy.
Can you
give me an example of that?
Well, a song like A Girl in Port off of the Stage Names is a... it's kind of like The Wanderer, you know. It's a swaggering, macho song of conquest in a certain sense, and it has this kind of Stonesy, you know, music to it. And we kind of wanted that to happen that way. And on the Stand-Ins, there's a song called "On Tour with Zykos," which presents a female perspective of the exact same thing, and a sort of a more small, deflated version of the male character in The Girl in Port. And so it kind of takes the wind out of the sails. It's like if, you know, the girls that he's mentioning in The Wanderer were writing about Dion and being like, oh, he's not that great, come on. He calls himself The Wanderer, but, you know, he's just a blowhard. So there's, you know, and then a certain song, like the second song on the Stage Names, Unless It's Kicks, is this kind of glorification of touring. And the second song on the Stand-Ins, Lost Coastlines, is sort of like the discontents of touring. So there's a little bit of that. There's also a sense that the Stage Names is about artists and the Stand-Ins is a little bit more about fans. Although those things do mingle a little bit.
They do.
I really like it when there's a sort of a yin-yang thing. You know, it's not like it's not like you've 100% separated things out. It's more just like a balance in different directions.
Let me play Lost Coastlines for people. And this is from the new Acaville River record called The Stand-Ins.
But I don't want to look so deep inside, yeah.
Sit down on the prow to wave by. There might not be another star.
You've got that You Can't Hurry Love, Lust for Life beat going on there.
Yeah, throughout both of the albums, we kind of constantly racked our brains about ways to put in allusions to other pop music. And because there's kind of this idea about the stand-ins and stage names of them sort of floating in this soup of referentiality you can't escape from. You know, there's a... it's pretty impossible as a band to do something that's new and to be... the idea of breaking entirely new ground. And I liked the idea of sort of creating a fractal world where you're just whirling more and more and more closely in on something else that's been done. And so there's like musical quotes throughout both records, lyrical quotes, plus ones off of this, stage names is like made almost entirely out of references to other songs. And there's references, you know, when we were recording that song too, we were thinking, oh, let's make the snare drum sound like a Rolling Stone, you know, let's put She's a Rainbow, the Rolling Stones quote in the end, you know, like we were just sort of geeking out on all the ways that we could hide little tidbits in there.
Can you tell me one tidbit I probably wouldn't figure, especially musical, the lyrical stuff we could get, maybe some of the beats we could get as all of us are fans, but maybe there's something so buried, so deep.
Well, I mean, like I said, at the end of Plus Ones that, you know, says let's get lost, let them send out alarms, says let's get crossed out and come to harm. I've always loved She's a Rainbow, and at one point in the little part of that, there's that do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, just kind of right. Climbing up to those chords. And that was a really great moment when Jonathan said, hey, you know, I could do that. We could throw that in there.
Says, let's get lost, let them send out alarms. He says, let's get crossed out and come to harm. Let's make the world's stupidest stand and truly mean it. Let's hit the limit of loss over lover's arms. No, let's succeed it.
That's good. Were these sessions done separate, or were they all done? Was it one session that you divided the record up? I'm not clear about that.
Well, like I said, it's kind of a mixture of both. Like I said, there were certain songs where we knew, you know, with Lost Coastlines, we thought, well, we're not even going to touch that till the next record, so we're just going to set that aside. And then there's another certain songs where we, on tour with Zykos, we were pretty sure what's going to be on the record, and then we thought, it was kind of right down to the wire. We thought, you know what, let's make a 9-song record. Let's just make it short, save that one for later. Mm-hmm. So I'd say about 75% to 80% of the record was done after the fact, but a lot of it was also done in the process of making the stage names.
Okay. I'm talking to Will Sheff of Acreville River, and you're playing DJ for me, but I'm tossing stuff your way too. Why don't you pick me some more?
This is another song. This is a woman named Lorraine Ellison, and she is a soul singer, and I guess the story with this was that Sinatra had his whole orchestra and all of his, you know, engineers and everything and the studio all booked, and he couldn't make it. And somehow Lorraine Ellison, this pretty unknown soul singer, ended up having access to all the Frank Sinatra goodies for that one day. And she went in and she recorded this song called Stay With Me, and made full use of every, as you'll hear, of all the bells and whistles that you get when you're Frank. And it's an unbelievably emotional. The arrangement is incredible. The orchestra is fantastic. Her performance is, you know, so wrenching that it brushes on over the top, which I guess is kind of a common theme with a lot of this stuff that I've been playing for you. I'm a big sucker for that kind of thing. That kind of, could it possibly, it's about to fall over. You know, it's gotten so huge that it might just fall over. This song feels pretty much like being, you know, at the eye of a hurricane or something. It feels pretty much like you're about to be blown into the wall by the emotional force that she's bringing to her performance. And it sounds really great, too.
That's great. Lorraine Ellison, and it's called Stay With Me. Get out your hankies.
Yeah.
Jeez. You know, you like stuff over the top. We had, you know, John Waters, yeah, filmmaker. Uh-huh. And yeah, he came in and played DJ for us on Valentine's Day, and he brought Lorraine Ellison song with him.
He's got incredible musical taste.
He does. So you're in good company. And I was trying to remember with Robin Hilton while we're playing, Robin's here in the studio. If I remember right, we couldn't bring down the fader on it either, because it just, every verse kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So we just let the thing play out.
I've always loved that moment where something that's incredibly stylized and your adult mind is saying, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. Give me a break. This is just unbelievably silly. is say, you know, you're saying all that when you're adult mind, but there's some kind of part inside of yourself that you just can't help it. You start to get choked up. You start to really feel it and believe it. And that's always been very, very magical and special to me, that kind of the way that we're so susceptible to melodrama. You know, you hear something like that and you go, come on, really? Another chorus with the screaming stay with me, baby? But at the same time, you're getting choked up, you know?
God. Do you ever, when you're singing on stage, get real involved with the tunes? I mean, here they are. You do them, you know, night after night. How many nights? These are tunes you know, you've lived with.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the time it has to do with, which this makes perfect sense, it has to do with what's been happening to me off stage, and not necessarily some kind of extremely personal thing. But, you know, sometimes I just sort of met somebody and I talked to them for a little while before the show, and they said something to me that sort of sticks with me for the entire show. And at some point that might come to a head.
Play me another song here, Will Sheff.
This is a wonderful song, very, very mysterious song. It's by this reggae group called Carlton in the Shoes, and a very strange name. We love this song so much that our drummer named his dog Carlton. It's beautiful, sparse, amazing production, very mysterious, very sweet and romantic song with a curiously somewhat paranoid message. You know, you sort of can get so caught up in the sweetness and the sexiness of it that you start to realize that it's very emotionally paranoid. And it's called Don't Give Your Heart Away Completely.
Carlton and the Shoes. Now, this is a band. This is sort of it's reggae, but it's more kind of rock steady than reggae, would you say?
I'm not the biggest reggae expert, but lovers rock, I think, is sort of the what some people might call it. And it's got this very smooth, it's almost, with the saxophone and everything, it's almost starting to get a little too smooth. But that's kind of what I really like about it, too. And there's that, the way that the reverb is and the way that the arrangement is, I always feel like I picture all the instruments kind of just floating in space and the whole thing is suspended. And the way that it's not so much of a verse and chorus, it's just sort of a different sets of call and response moments. And they're all very, these sort of koanic, somewhat sweet, somewhat paranoid things like, never give your heart away until you know that someone who's sharing it won't burn your heart to cinders. Mm-hmm. You know? And that whole never give your heart away completely, give your heart away completely. And later in the song they say, remember I've told you, remember I'm warning you.
Very cool. We'll put that entire song up on Live Flows here. Can I play, I'll play a song of yours. Maybe if you have a preference. I was thinking of maybe Starry Stairs.
That would be great.
And maybe you tell me a little about the song, point out things as it plays? Let's just try that, and if not, we'll do it a different way. But
okay.
I'm gonna leave you.
Can I do a little sort of introduction to it before you play it?
Sure, and I'll leave your microphone open when we play it so you can just interject stuff.
This song had an interesting process that it went through. When I wrote it, it was kind of like a riffy guitar velvets-y thing, and it had entirely different lyrics. When we started working it up, we kept being frustrated with that approach musically. You know, it just never was quite working. And very slowly, it started to turn into a soul song. And once we realized that that's what we wanted to do, we went further and further and further. And we started doing a very Al Green, rhythmic emphasis, Al Green, direct kind of Al Green beat. And we were putting in sort of more modern touches too, and we ended up getting the horn section that actually plays with Prince a lot to do some of the horns on there, which we recorded in a very kind of dead Southern soul way. And as we started doing that, and as it started turning into this soul song, I realized that the lyrics I'd written for it were totally inappropriate and didn't really have anything to do with the sound. And so I went home and I rewrote 95% of the lyrics and made it an entirely different song about an entirely different character, entirely different person. And that was when I had this idea in a weird kind of flash to make it about this porn actress, Savannah, and, you know, who had a tragic death by suicide.
Which you learn about on the first of these two records, yeah.
Yes. And that was when I sort of wrote those two songs together. She had an interesting life, you know, real lonely childhood, became a groupie kind of early in her life and was romantically linked to all sorts of LA rock musicians and got into pornography and dancing and stuff like that. And in the end, she decided to, she got in a car accident. And
real cheery little thing, yeah.
Yeah, it was not a big deal, but she thought she couldn't work anymore and she killed herself. It's a very sad story. But in this song, I wanted to write from her perspective and kind of have it be her giving the finger to everyone who has an issue with her and really bring a lot of compassion and love and defense of this character to the song. And so I think of this song as very full of positive energy. Maybe it's sort of angry positive energy, but full of life energy and not too bleak. It's one of my favorite songs that I've ever recorded. I really am happy with the way it all came out.
Oh, sweet. Let's hear it.
From horror, what do you think this fan club is for? I slithered up each rose corridor. I kept a warm, safe place at my core. Before I lost it, they asked for blood. What do you think this woman's made of? I stuck a small thin pin in my thumb. They dreamt a low, long line to be crossed.
Now here come the the mellotron and the horns. Listen to Al Green for hours trying to come up with a very Al Green like horn section there. Horns were actually playing into a curtain to get a real dead horn sound.
Who wrote the arrangements for the horns?
I wrote them with Brian Beattie, the producer. We basically just had the horn guys in there and said, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do this? Oh, that doesn't work. Try this instead, you know.
And when you say, why don't you do this, did you just say, go ba ba ba?
Yeah, ba 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 ba.
Okay. Let's hear a little more.
And then when I was singing the song, I just sort of ad-libbed this quote that Savannah had that she made at the AVN Awards. If you don't love me, I'm sorry. It's just an ad-lib right here.
If you don't love me, I'm sorry.
That think that kind of stuff probably adds to a performer's love of something. When you do something in a studio that surprises you, it endears you to it, and also, do you think that's true?
Yeah, and I think that love adds to the texture of a recording, you know, or anything. It's like when something has been loved and labored over, whether it's a meal or a song or a building that somebody built, you know, it's you can tell. And even if you can't physically, literally tell by looking at it or touching it, you can actually feel it. I always feel like when I play a really old, really wonderful old instrument, that it's gathered all this energy from all the hands that have held it and played it and loved playing it. And it sort of started to very quietly glow from that human energy and that human love. And I've always felt like, you know, in the studio when we work, I try to really lavish love on every aspect of everything and just make it glow with that energy and warmth, and even pay attention when I don't need to be. You know, when I'm sitting there on the couch and somebody else is doing their overdub and it's a pretty straightforward thing, I guess I kind of foolishly think that if it passes through the brains and ears of people who are listening very carefully to it, it gets warmed up a little bit before it hits the tape, you know?
That's great. I'd love you to take us out on one more thing. It's been a pleasure having you today, Will Scheff.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
Will Scheff's new record with Acquaville River, of course, is called The Stand-Ins. One second. Robin, we have the concert that we did with Acquaville is online still, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We have a
one where I've shredded my voice by the end of it. That was a traumatic show, I have to say.
In what way?
Oh, I was just, as I recall, I was kind of sick. And I had been touring kind of perpetually, yeah. And I was like, oh, great, NPR is here to document the gradual demise of my voice. And by the end, I think I really did sound like some kind of cackling skeleton. But it was a really fun show. I just remember thinking, oh, it's kind of like a vocal snuff film going on here tonight.
Well, you can hear that vocal snuff film online at NPR.org. Never thought that those words would be in a sentence that I would say. And Will Scheff, take us out on a song, and thanks to KJZZ for hosting you there.
This is a song I love and treasure. I heard about it through Patrick, our bass player, who heard about it through, I believe, Dominic Wellhouse, who lives in Austin, who is a record collector. Amazing taste, amazing collection. He and this guy, Mike Maraconda, have these record parties in Austin. This song was the one that was hardest for you guys to track down when I told you about it, and I still don't really know very much about it. I used to think it was an old, very cheaply recorded soul song, but I actually think it's some kind of garage rock band from Syracuse, New York, called The Penetrators, with a singer whose name is Curtis Seals, singing. I don't know who wrote the song. I don't know very much about it, but it is so crazy sounding in the production, so full of energy, so full of rock and roll and soul energy. And I think it really does sort of stand as proof that even in an internet age where you can find out anything about anything, there are still things you can't find out about. This is totally unavailable online or anything. I got it ripped off of a 45 single. It's called The Scandalizer, and it is a favorite song of everyone in Acquaville River.
Well, let's do this, Will. Let's put this song on our blog when we do put up the show on Monday.
Oh, that would be great.
And then let's see what people have to write about it and see. Well, let's all learn.
Excellent.
And let's hear the song. This is by The Penetrators, we think.
With Curtis Seals singing, I think.
We think.
I think that's what it is.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure having you. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that would be fine.
Yes. I'm the best around. Don't say I'm a gambler. A midnight rambler, yeah. Oh, I ain't a gambler. I gave my favor. You're mad, Lisa. You're a mad Lisa. Save her. I'm the scandalizer. Ain't nobody nicer. What you say? I'm the best around. Unless you see me walk down your street, don't stop me, baby. There's someone I got to be. So baby, baby, I see you around. Come and answer your service, and we'll get down. Yeah, yeah. I'm the scandalizer.
Oh, sweet D. I'm the best around.
Rapper, babe.
I'm the best around.